This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
In the midst of so many other changes, this can be easy to miss. But in clinical research and therapeutic product development, the very definition and nature of the word evidence is changing. The traditional gold standard of evidence generated from randomized clinical trials is not being replaced, but it is being supplemented by new types and sources of data, such as electronic health records, patient and disease registries, and wearable digital devices. As science and technology continue to change clinical research, is our definition of the word evidence also evolving? I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. My guest today is Mr. Michael Seawald. Michael serves as worldwide head of the Center for Excellence for Real-World Evidence for Novartis Pharma in Switzerland. He also serves on the program committee of DIA's upcoming Future of Evidence workshop in Basel. Michael, thank you very much for joining us today and welcome.
Alberto, thank you so much for the introduction.
Beginning with the HTA bodies, the health technology agency bodies, can you tell me what steps do HTA bodies take to view real-world data as useful real-world evidence?
Let me take a step back and share a little bit about how HTA actually works. So essentially, health technology assessment is a multidisciplinary process that builds on the summaries of information about a number of issues and entities. And so it's being looked at to understand medical issues, social issues, economic issues, and ethical issues, and then how that relates to the use of a health technology in a systematic, transparent, unbiased, and robust manner. And that's a lot. And to be able to support decision making, HTA agencies collect and assess information across a wide range of areas. And so there are some differences country to country, but typically this is focused very much on understanding the medical and the economic impact of new therapies and pharmaceuticals on behalf of the individual patient and on the healthcare system as a whole. Now, coming to the question related to what is useful real-world evidence, first of all, we need to acknowledge that HTA is looking for evidence, and then real-world evidence plays a role in that context. It typically means it needs to be fit for purpose. And then the question is, what is the context? What is the purpose? And it's all about the decision making. So the actual steps are actually very easy to understand. It's about, first of all, what is the decision to be taken? Is it, for instance, initial reimbursement? Is it a conditional reimbursement scheme that may already be quite different then? But next to the decision, what is the evidence needed to take that decision? And in that instance, for instance, trial data, but also real-world evidence can be very acceptable to close the gap. So once the gap is understood, the next step would be to define what is the study design or the methodology that needs to be followed to come to a fit-for-purpose answer to support the decision. And then finally, the last step will be to conduct the actual research and provide the evidence back in support of the decision. It's so fascinating to see HTA bodies focused on providing a great and a robust answer locally. And the steps are very similar, but in a local context, you can imagine in a healthcare system that may look very different situation by situation.
I guess we all understand that HTA bodies are not all created equal and do not all have equal capabilities and depth and breadth, sometimes due to limited resources. So is it fair to say that HTAs generally will not collect real-world evidence themselves, but will rely on sponsors to collect that evidence and present it to HTAs? Is that generally correct?
That is generally correct. And also from a sponsor point of view, I believe that is a fine way of doing it. The sponsor company bringing the innovation, the new therapy to the market is usually inclined to do this timely. And it can be, of course, very timely if things are clear, if kind of the rules of the game from an HTA point of view are clear and from a sponsor point of view are clear. And then an evidence dossier can be brought forward that ideally provides all information for decision making without the need for iterations and subsequent clinical research.
Are HTAs generally willing to or even happy to sit down with sponsors from pharma and design together a protocol or study to collect real-world data that can be useful real-world evidence? Are they willing to actually sit down and have those discussions? And maybe some HTAs do and some don't.
And this has been looked at across Europe, for instance, across the major HTA bodies. And indeed, actually, the openness for real-world data and real-world evidence is, I would say, quite good. So, for instance, for a decision related to initial reimbursement, there's usually even a clear encouragement to bring real-world evidence. When it comes to pharma economic analysis or when it comes to conditional reimbursement schemes, it looks slightly different, once again, country by country. But in general, and for the majority of HTA bodies, actually there is good support to look at real-world data and look at study output, which then we would call real-world evidence.
Similar perhaps to scientific advice with the European Medicines Agency, with regulators and sponsors sit down and they say, okay, this is the study that will be done. Can HTAs and sponsors do that?
Yes, so specifically for conditional reimbursement schemes, that actually is very often done. And it depends, again, country by country, how much would the HTA body predefine what needs to be done or how much are they open for a dialogue. But in principle, there is a dialogue and I think also should be, and this is also something that is being appreciated by all parties.
Does the approach of HTAs that we've just discussed differ in some way from the work done by clinicians to generate clinical evidence from these data or by regulators to generate regulatory evidence that they can use for regulatory decision making? Does the HTA approach differ from these two other constituents, clinicians and regulators?
There's unfortunately a very clear answer to that, which is that if you look at the decision making by the HTA agencies, you see that they come to different conclusions on the medical impact of the new pharmaceuticals. So country by country, we look at different outcomes. And so there is this variability and variation across the HTA bodies. And it tells you already that not everybody, unfortunately, comes to the same conclusion. And that is actually an issue because when it comes to safety and efficacy, everybody may be using the same data, but it's not necessarily leading to the same conclusions. This is because the agencies have different approaches to rating and interpreting the data. And this may then, you know, be how the agencies look at trial design, at endpoints, at appropriateness of certain subgroups and treatment comparators. And to go on your question related to regulators, unfortunately, we see also that HTA agencies can be out of step with the outcomes of the EMA review of a medicine. And from a company point of view, this is not great because we have essentially duplicative work as part of the reimbursement process. And it may actually also lead to a delay for patients in terms of getting access to the drug. So to comment on that, you know, there's certainly progress. And for instance, we see a dialogue now all across Europe that, for instance, something like relative efficacy assessments, which are needed at the time of launch, are done in collaboration across Europe, such that jointly conclusions are taken. Such collaboration can take out the duplicative work. And in principle, there has been clear progress over the last couple of years.
That was exactly my follow-up question, because the situation you've described reminds me of regulatory fragmentation before, in 1992, before European Medicines Agency, where companies had to deal with 28 different countries that each had its own preference. So there seems to be a degree of fragmentation among HTAs, certainly across Europe. Is a degree of HTA harmonization desirable?
This fragmentation is what is the issue. That's exactly right. And to some degree, we can overcome it. To the degree that very local assessments are becoming relevant, for instance, related to local cost structures, related to local medical needs, which can be different, there may be different outcomes, and there certainly is a local assessment needed in some situations. So it's not about necessarily making it all the same, that may not work, but coming to a similar view on the relative efficacy, for instance, that should be possible. And I think this is where the progress also has been noted.
Let's move to patients, obviously key participants and beneficiaries of the entire effort in medicine's development. Patient engagement, of course, has emerged very prominently in this ecosystem. Has it changed the role of real-world evidence in product development and in making value and access decisions?
Yeah, so I'd say the largest impact has been on the choice of endpoints for product development. We have now, I think, very well recognized that while the clinical endpoints are very important to demonstrate efficacy and safety for a new therapy, such clinical endpoints may not always be the most important endpoints from a patient perspective. So for instance, in a respiratory product development situation, you may find that FEV1 measurements are used to show efficacy, but maybe from a patient point of view, individually, exacerbations may be very important as well, or potentially for some patients can be even the most important perspective on the
study. That's right.
And so now this is why routinely we're embracing the patient perspective as part of product development, and there is patient engagement in a very well-structured process. Sometimes we call it patient voice, and you may see this sometimes in literature. It's really about seeking input. It's really about having a well-defined information exchange. It's about seeking patients' input on particular topics. For instance, which outcomes matter most to patients? And then, of course, what does it mean for the rest of the program? Are we on track? If we look at what matters most to patients, what are patient preferences? And there are very, very nice initiatives going on across the globe, making important scientific progress on how can we get better at understanding patient preferences and making them part of the medicine's development. And on other occasions, it's maybe not a direct dialogue with patients, but it's about understanding the patient journey, which is then about patient experiences. And understanding that part with real-world evidence is really important because it helps us to bring medicines to the market with better data sets and also be able to address the unmet needs in the most effective way. But coming back to the endpoints, what it really means is that in the ideal case, we have, for instance, patient-reported outcomes included in pivotal clinical studies. And then, of course, we would see them included also in the product label. And especially the latter can be of great help when it comes to value and access decisions. This is how the loop is closing. I think industry has really learned over the last couple of years from all of this. And once again, I think there's very good progress to make the outcomes matter more to patients. And we do see this is appreciated by access decision makers.
It sounds like compared to past years, where perhaps there was a lot of resistance on the part of pharma and maybe even clinicians to involve patients in protocol design, now that resistance has pretty well crumbled, maybe even vanished. Is that fair to say?
I think it's a case-by-case assessment needed. The process gets larger and complex. And what took us a while is to keep the streamlining, keep the speed, because all of that ideally wouldn't necessarily make all the R&D efforts more elongated and more expensive. Because some of the, for instance, patient-reported outcomes can also be studied after the product is launched. And if you now bring all of this upfront as a requirement into the R&D process, it does get a bit convoluted. So I think some of the progress was necessary to streamline and improve at the same point in time. That's probably the way going forward as well.
Some people have said that not including the patient voice in drug development is far more risky than including it. Do you agree with that?
And I've been part of quite a number of product launches over the last 15 years, is that if you basically engage with patient groups, if you talk to patient leaders, it is actually remarkable how much appreciation there is for new therapies that change the practice of medicine and that make a difference. And along those lines, this is just exactly the guidance that we actually also needed. And I can very well understand the person who said this, brought forward the statement. There's a lot in it for sure.
Let me move to another hot topic, and that's analytics. There's much talk about analytics these days. And in this context, our conversation, what is the practical meaning and the usefulness of analytics when they are applied to real-world data and real-world evidence?
The issue is across the industry, but certainly not just healthcare, we have quite a number of buzzwords coming up. Buzzwords like artificial intelligence, cognition is being mentioned there.
Machine learning.
Machine learning is mentioned, right? I mean, much of that goes back to progress achieved by mathematicians and statisticians decades ago. So what is really new and what is the excitement about analytics? I think to some degree, this is well justified. We do have better data than decades ago. And of course, now those well-established methodologies can be tried further and be further developed. This is great, and there certainly is practical meaning and usefulness, going back to your question, when it comes to those items. So if electronic medical record in a hospital is now so well set up that within a fraction of seconds, a relevant alert can be shown to clinicians and to nurses, that is a very good thing for sure, and that is real progress. This is what I see with practical meaning and usefulness. Calling everything machine learning, and then maybe in the end you look at logarithmic regression, I don't really see this as progress. We should take this very a bit more serious than just, you know, inventing new terms, and then making sure it has the clinical relevance and also robustness that we need, because these are actual clinical decisions being supported. And we want to have them reliable, because that is most important. And pointing that out, not everything is clear right now. For instance, the use of artificial intelligence and machine learning has a lot of ethical implications, which we are just now discussing publicly. It is not necessarily well appreciated that machine learning algorithms need maintenance over time. So what can happen, for instance, is if you deploy machine learning algorithms in a clinical practice, you may find out that they may work in the first couple of weeks, but months later, when the rest of the medical record system has been changed and has adjusted, you may need to fine-tune those algorithms again. And these are important issues that we still need to find solutions for. And this is where we need to be quite careful. But impact of analytics is huge, and it makes a difference. And we are in a completely different space as compared to 10 or 15 or 20 years before.
It sounds from your comments that the real value of analytics is in bringing it very, very close to the patient and the clinician, so that the impact is seen really at the patient level, where it matters to the patient and to the decisions that a clinician must make sometimes very quickly. Fair enough?
I think that's fair, and while I'm not necessarily a big fan of those buzzwords, as you can already imagine, based on my comments, personalized medicine being another buzzword, what is true is, of course, with more data and with better algorithms, we can take it from larger populations to very meaningful insights for subgroups and sometimes even individual patients. And that is also progress that has happened over the last 10, 15 years. And that is amazing in itself. We're not, you know, looking at everybody the same. We now increasingly see the patterns that make a difference. And they are clinically relevant. And with some of the therapies, we already have figured out how individualized and personalized treatment options and algorithms can actually be used. And that is amazing.
Finally, Michael, before we close, a randomized clinical trial has been the gold standard for evidence generation for decades. Now, real-world evidence has become the hot topic in clinical research. Looking to the future, what new or different sources of evidence do you foresee?
Let me point to a few sources of evidence which I find particularly interesting and exciting. Good. So I see the whole industry essentially moving from we run individual trials and we run one-off studies because we needed to. We're moving to more collaborations. And as part of moving to collaborations and as part of working with robust data, we move towards data collections, which remain in place after a particular study has been concluded. So such data sources kind of build up year over year, which means we essentially, by running a study, we create a feedback loop. We get a scientific result, and we take part of the output to improve the data collection going forward. And for me, the most exciting element of all of this is really that in certain therapy areas, we begin to share so much information that we can come to new products over time. Let me mention diseases like, for instance, Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, as diseases where we have where we know already product development is really, really difficult. And in those areas, we now see a lot of collaboration and sharing, and over time, industry, but also academia will be able to make exciting progress in exactly those disease areas where product development is already very, very difficult. So this is what I see for the future. It's not necessarily trials versus real-world evidence. That is not particularly helpful because either type of evidence, either type of data has its place and it's complementary. I think the exciting development is really in this collaboration space and developing data sources over the time frame of decades that at some point will revolutionize healthcare in the respective therapy area.
Michael, we've come to the end of our time together. I want to thank you for your time and insights and great experience. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.